Dolores Claiborne by Stephen King. Read by Francis Sternhagen. What did you ask, Andy Bessette? Do I understand these rites as you've explained them to me? Gory, what makes some men so numb? No, you never mind. Still your join and listen to me for a while. I got an idea you're going to be listening to me most of the night, so you might as well get used to it. Course I understand what you read to me. Do I look like I lost all my brains since I seen you down to the market? That was just Monday afternoon, in case you lost track. I told you your wife would give you merry hell about buying that day-old bread. Penny-wise and pound-foolish, the old saying is. And I bet I was right, wasn't I? I understand my rights just fine, Andy. Patricia Claiborne bore 5 boys and 6 girls and wasn't one of them raised foolish. I understand my rights and my responsibilities, too, God help me. Anything I say might be used against me in a court of law, you say? Well, will wonders never cease? And you can just get that smirk off your face, Frank Prue. You may be a hotshot town cop these days, but it hasn't been too long since I seen you running around in a soggy diaper with that same foolish grin on your face. I'll give you a little piece of advice. When you get around an old biddy like me, you just want to save that grin. I can read you easier than an underwear ad in the Sears catalog. All right, we've had our fun. Might as well get down to it. I'm going to tell you 3 a hell of a lot, starting right about now. And a hell of a lot of it probably could be used against me in a court of law, if anyone wanted to at this late date. The joke of it is folks on the island know most of it already. And I'm just about half past give a shit, as old Neely Robichaux used to say when he was in his cups, which was most of the time, as anyone who knew him will tell you. I do give a shit about one thing, though, and that's why I come down here on my own hook. I didn't kill that bitch, Vera Donovan, and no matter what you think now, I intend to make you believe that. I didn't push her down that friggin' staircase. It's fine if you want to lock me up for the other, but I don't have none of that bitch's blood on my hands, and I think you will believe that by the time I'm finished, Andy. You was always a good enough boy, as boys go. Fair-minded is what I mean. And you've turned into a decent man. Don't let it go to your head, though. You grew up same as any other man, with some woman to wash your clothes and wipe your nose and turn you around when you got yourself pointed in the wrong direction. One other thing before we get started. I know you, Andy, and Frank, of course, but who's this woman with the tape recorder? Oh, Christ, Andy, I know she's a stenographer. Didn't I just tell you my mama didn't raise any fools? I may be 66 come this November, but I still got all my marbles. I know a woman with a tape recorder and a shorthand pants is stenographer. And I watch all those courtroom shows, even that L.A. Law, where nobody can seem to keep their clothes on for 15 minutes at a time. What's your name, honey? Uh-huh. And whereabouts do you hail from? Oh, put a sock in it, Andy. What else you got to do tonight? Was you planning to go over to the shingle and see if you could catch a few fellas digging quahogs without a license? That'd probably be more excitement than your heart could take, wouldn't it? Ha! Huh? There, that's better. You're Nancy Bannister from Kennebunk, and I'm Dolores Claiborne from right here on Little Tall Island. Now, I already said I'm going to do a country fair job of talking before we're done in here, and you're going to find I wasn't lying a bit. So if you need me to speak up or slow down, just say so. You needn't be shy with me. I want you to get every goddamn word, starting with this. 29 years ago, when Police Chief Bessette here was in the first grade and still eating the paste off the back of his pitches, I killed my husband, Joe St. George. I feel a draft in here, Andy. Might go away if you shut your goddamn trap. I don't know what you're looking so surprised about anyway. You know I killed Joe. Everybody on Little Tall knows it. And probably half the people across the reach in Jonesport know it, too. It's just that nobody could prove it. And I wouldn't be here now admitting it in front of Frank Prue and Nancy Bannister from Kennebunk if it hadn't been for that stupid bitch Vera getting up to more of her nasty old tricks. Well, she'll never get up to any more of them, will she? There's that for consolation, at least. Shift that recorder a little closer to me, Nancy, dear. If this is going to get done, it'll get done right, I'll be bound. Don't those Japanese just make the most cunning little things? Yes, indeed. But I guess we both know that what's going on the tape inside that little cutie pie could put me in the women's correctional for the rest of my life. Still, I don't have no choice. I swear before heaven I always knew that Vera Donovan just about be the death of me. I knew it from the first time I saw her. And look what she's done. Just look what that goddamn old bitch has done to me. This time she's really stuck her gum in my gears. But that's rich people for you. If they can't kick you to death, they're apt to kiss you to death with kindness. What? Oh, gory, I'm getting to it, Andy, if you'll just give me a little peace. I'm just trying to decide if I should tell it back to front or front to back. I don't suppose I could have a little drink, could I? Oh, frig your coffee. Take the whole pot and shove it up your kazoo. Just give me a glass of water if you're too cheap to part with a swallow of the beam you keep in your desk drawer. I ain't... What do you mean? How do I know that? Why, Andy Bissett, someone who didn't know better'd think you just toddled out of a saltine's box yesterday. Do you think me killing my husband's the only thing the folks on this island have got to talk about? Hell, that's old news. You, now. You still got some juice left in you. Thank you, Frank. You was always a pretty good boy, too. Although you was kind of hard to look at in church until your mother got you cured of the booger-hooking habit. Gory, there were times when you had that finger so far up your nose it was a wonder you didn't poke your brains out. And what the hell are you blushing for? Was never a kid alive who didn't mine a little green gold out of their old pump every now and then. At least you knew enough to keep your hands out of your pants and off your nuts, at least in church. And there's a lot of boys who never... Yes, Andy, yes, I am gonna tell it. Jeezly Crow, you ain't never shook the ants out of your pants, have you? Tell you what, I'm gonna compromise. Instead of telling her front to back or back to front, I'm going to start in the middle and just kind of work both ways. And if you don't like it, Andy Bissett, you can write it up on your TS list and take it to the chaplain. Me and Joe had three kids. And when he died in the summer of 63, Selena was 15, Joe Jr. was 13, and little Pete was just 9. Well... Joe didn't leave me a pot to piss in and hardly a window to throw it out of. I guess you'll have to fix this up some, Nancy, won't you? I'm just an old woman with a foul temper and a fouler mouth. But that's what happens more often than not when you've had a foul life. Now, where was I? I ain't lost my place already, have I? Oh, yes. Thank you, honey bun. What Joe left me with... was that shacky little place out by the East Head and 6 acres of land. Most of it blackberry tangles and the kind of trash wood that grows back after a clear-cut operation. What else? Let me see. 3 trucks that didn't run, 2 pickups and a pulp hauler, 4 cord of wood, a bill at the grocery, a bill at the hardware, a bill with the oil company, a bill with the funeral home. And you want the icing on the goddamn cake? He went a week in the ground before that rum pot, Harry Doucette, come over with a friggin' IOU that said Joe owed him $20 on a baseball bet. He left me all that, but do you think he left me any goddamn insurance money? No, sir. Although that might have been a blessing in disguise the way things turned out. I guess I'll get to that part before I'm done. But all I'm trying to say now is that Joe St. George really wasn't a man at all. He was a goddamn millstone I wore around my neck. Worse, really, because a millstone don't get drunk and then come home smelling of beer and wanting to throw a fuck into you at 1 a.m. Wasn't none of that the reason why I killed the son of a whore? But I guess it's as good a place as any to start. An island's not a good place to kill anybody, I can tell you that. Seems like there's always someone around itching to get his nose into your business just when you can least afford it. That's why I did it when I did, and I'll get to that too. For now, suffice it to say that I did it just about 3 years after Vera Donovan's husband died in a motor accident outside of Baltimore, which was where they lived when they wasn't summering on Little Tall. Back in those days, most of Vera's screws were still nice and tight. With Joe out of the picture and no money coming in, I was in a fix, I can tell you. I got an idea there's no one in the whole world feels as desperate as a woman on her own with kids depending on her. I'd about decided I'd better cross the reach and see if I couldn't get a job in Jonesport, checking out groceries at the Shop and Save or waitressing in a restaurant, when that numb pussy all of a sudden showed up on the ferry and said she was going to live on the island all year round. Most everyone thought she'd blown a fuse, me included, and that she'd change her mind before long. But she never. The fellow who worked for her in those days, I don't remember his name, but you know who I mean, Andy, that dumb hunky that always wore his pants tight enough to show the world he had balls as big as mason jars, called me up and said, "The missus," that's what he always called her, "the missus." My, wasn't he dumb. Wanted to know if I'd come to work for her full-time as her housekeeper. Well, I'd done it summers for the family since 1950, and I suppose it was natural enough for her to call me before she called anyone else, but at the time it seemed like the answer to all my prayers. I said yes right on the spot, and I worked for her right up until yesterday forenoon, when she went down the front stairs on a stupid empty head. What was it her husband did, Andy? Made airplanes, didn't he? Oh, eh, I guess I did hear that. But you know how people on the island talk. All I know for sure is that they was well fixed, mighty well fixed. And she got it all when he died, except for what the government took, of course. And I doubt if it got anywhere near as much as it was probably owed. Michael Donovan was sharp as a tack, sly, too. And although nobody would believe it from the way she was over the last 10 years, Vera was as sly as he was. And she had her sly days right up until she died. I wonder if she knew what kind of a jam she'd be leaving me in if she did anything besides die in bed of a nice quiet heart attack. I've been down by East Head most of the day, sitting on those rickety stairs and thinking about that. That and a few hundred other things. First, I'd think, no, a bowl of oatmeal has more brains than Vera Donovan had at the end. And then I'd remember how she was about the vacuum cleaner. And I'd think, maybe, yes, maybe. But it don't matter now. The only thing that matters now is that I have flopped out of the frying pan and into the fire. And I'd dearly love to drag myself clear before my ass gets burned any worse, if I still can. I started off as Vera Donovan's housekeeper, and I ended up being something they called a paid companion. It didn't take me too long to figure out the difference. As Vera's housekeeper, I had to eat shit 8 hours a day, 5 days a week. As her paid companion, I had to eat it all the way around the clock. She had her first stroke in the summer of 1968. While she was watching the Democratic National Convention in Chicago on her television. That was just a little one, and she used to blame it on Hubert Humphrey. "I finally looked at that happy asshole one too many times," she said, "and I popped a goddamn blood vessel. I should have known it was going to happen, and it could just as easily have been Nixon." She had a bigger one in 1975, and that time she didn't have no politicians to blame it on. Dr. Freneau told her she'd better quit smoking and drinking, but he could have saved his breath. No high-stepping kitty like Vera Kiss My Back Cheeks Donovan was going to listen to a plain old country doctor like Chip Freneau. "I'll bury him," she used to say, "and have a scotch and soda sitting on his headstone." For a while it seemed like maybe she would do just that. He kept scolding her, and she kept sailing along like the Queen Mary. Then in 1981, she had her first whopper, and the hunky got killed in a car wreck over on the mainland the very next year. That was when I moved in with her, October of 1982. Did I have to? I don't know. I guess not. I had my sociable security, as old Hattie McLeod used to call it. It wasn't much, but the kids were long gone by then, little Pete right off the face of the earth. Poor little lost lamb. And I had managed to put a few dollars away, too. Living on the island has always been cheap, and while it ain't what it once was, It's still a whale of a lot cheaper than living on the mainland. So I guess I didn't have to go live with Vera, no. But by then, her and me was used to each other. It's hard to explain to a man. I expect Nancy there with her pads and pens and tape recorder understands, but I don't think she's supposed to talk. We was used to each other, in the way I suppose two old bats can get used to hanging upside down next to each other in the same cave, even though they're a long way from what you'd call the best of friends. And it really wasn't no big change. Hanging my Sunday clothes in the closet next to my house dresses was really the biggest part of it. Because by the fall of 82, I was there all day, every day, and most nights as well. The money was a little better, but not so good I'd made the down payment on my first Cadillac, if you know what I mean. Ha! Huh. I guess I did it mostly because there wasn't nobody else. She had a business manager down in Washington, D.C., a man named Greenbush. But Greenbush weren't going to come up to Little Tall so she could scream down at him from her bedroom window to be sure and hang those sheets with six pins, not four. Nor was he going to move into the guest room and change her diapers and wipe the shit off her fat old ass while she accused him of stealing the dimes out of a goddamn china pig and told him how she was going to see him in jail for it. Greenbush cut the checks. I cleaned up her shit and listened to her rave on about the sheets and the dust bunnies and her goddamn china pig. And what of it? I don't expect no medal for it. Not even a Purple Heart. I've wiped out a lot of shit in my time, listened to even more of it. I was married to Joe St. George for 16 years, remember? And none of it ever gave me the rickets. I guess in the end I stuck with her because she didn't have nobody else. It was either me or the nursing home. Her kids never came to see her, and that was one thing I felt sorry for her about. I didn't expect them to pitch in, don't get that idea. But I didn't see why they couldn't mend their old quarrel, whatever it was, and come once in a while to spend the day, or maybe a weekend with her. She was a miserable bitch, no doubt about it, but she was their ma, and by then she was old. Of course, I know a lot more than I did then, but... What? Yes, it's true. If I'm lying, I'm dying, as my grandson says. You just call that fella Greenbush if you don't believe me. I expect when the news gets out, and it will, it always does, there'll be one of those soppy articles in the Bangor Daily News about how the rich lady from away left good golly what-all to her poor country mouse companion from the island and how wonderful it all is. Well, I got news for you. It ain't wonderful. A friggin' nightmare is what it is. No matter what happens in here, folks are going to say I brainwashed her into doing what she done and then killed her. I know it, Andy, and so do you. There ain't no power in heaven or on earth that can stop people from thinking the worst when they want to. Well, not one goddamn word of it is true. I didn't force her to do nothing, and she sure didn't do what she did because she loved me or even liked me. I suppose she might have done it because she thought she owed me. In her own peculiar way, she could have thought she owed me plenty, and 'twouldn't have been her way to say anything. Could even be what she done was her way of thanking me, not for changing her shitty diapers, but for being there on all the nights when the wires came out of the corners or the dust bunnies came out from under the bed. You don't understand that, I know, but you will. Before you open that door and walk out of this room, I promise you'll understand everything. She had three ways of being a bitch. I've known women who had more, but three's good for a senile old lady mostly stuck in a wheelchair or in bed. Three's damn good for a woman like that. The first way was when she was a bitch because she couldn't help it. You remember what I said about the clothespins, how you had to use six of them to hang the sheets, never just four? Well, that was just one example. There were certain ways things had to be done if you worked for Mrs. Kiss My Back Cheeks Vera Donovan, and you didn't want to forget a single one of them. She told you how things were going to go right up front, and I'm here to tell you that's how things went. If you forgot something once, you got the rough side of her tongue. If you forgot twice, you got docked on payday. If you forgot three times, that was it. You were down the road and no excuses listened to. That was Vera's rule, and it sat all right with me. I thought it was hard, but I thought it was fair. If you was told twice which rack she wanted the bacon put on after it came out of the oven and not ever to stick it on the kitchen windowsills to cool like Shanty Irish would do, and if you still couldn't remember, The chances were good you wasn't never going to remember. 3 strikes and you're out was the rule. There was absolutely no exceptions to it. And I worked with a lot of different people in that house over the years because of it. I heard it said more than once in the old days that working for the Donovans was like stepping into one of those revolving doors. You might get 1 spin or 2, and some folks went around as many as 10 times or 12, but you always got spat out onto the sidewalk in the end. So when I went to work for her in the first place, this was in 1949, the year after Selena was born, I went like you'd go into a dragon's cave. But she wasn't as bad as people like to make out. If you kept your ears open, you could say. I did, and the hunky did, too. But you had to stay on your toes all the time because she was sharp, because she always knew more of what was going on with the island folk than any of the other summer people did, and because she could be mean. Even back then, before all her other troubles befell her, she could be mean. It was like a hobby with her. "What are you doing here?" she says to me on that first day. "Shouldn't you be home minding that new baby of yours and making nice big dinners for the light of your life?" "Mrs. Cullum's happy to watch Selena 4 hours a day, I said. "Part-time is all I can take, ma'am." "Part-time is all I need, as I believe my advertisement in the local excuse for a newspaper said," she comes right back, just showing me the edge of that sharp tongue of hers. Not actually cutting me with it like she would so many times later. She was knitting that day, as I remember. That woman could knit like a flash. A whole pair of socks in a single day was no problem for her, even if she started as late as 10 o'clock. But she said she had to be in the mood. "Yes'm," I said. It did. "My name isn't Yes'm," she said, putting her knitting down. "It's Vera Donovan. If I hire you, you'll call me Mrs. Donovan, at least until we know each other well enough to make a change. And I'll call you Dolores. Is that clear?" "Yes'm, Mrs. Donovan," I said. "All right, we're off to a good start. Now answer my question. What are you doing here when you've got a house of your own to keep, Dolores?" "I want to earn a little extra money for Christmas," I said. I'd already decided on my way over I'd say that if she asked. "And if I'm satisfactory until then, and if I like working for you, of course, maybe I'll stay on a little longer." "If you like working for me," she repeats back, then rolls her eyes like it was the silliest thing she'd ever heard. How could anybody not like working for the great Vera Donovan? Then she repeats back, "Christmas money." She takes a pause, looking at me the whole time, then says it again, even more sarcastic. "Christmas money!" Like she suspected, I was really there because I barely had the rice shook out of my hair and was having marriage troubles already. And she only wanted to see me blush and drop my eyes to know for sure. So I didn't blush, and I didn't drop my eyes, although I was only 22 and it was a near thing. Nor would I have admitted to a single soul that I was already having trouble. Wild horses wouldn't have dragged it out of me. Christmas money was good enough for Vera, no matter how sarcastic she might say it. And all I'd allowed to myself was that the house money was a little tight that summer. It was only years later that I could admit the real reason why I went up to face the dragon in her den that day. I had to find a way to put back some of the money Joe was drinking up through the week and losing in the Friday night poker games in the back room of Fudgy's Tavern over on the mainland. In those days, I still believed the love of a man for a woman and a woman for a man was stronger than the love of drinking and hell-raising, that love would eventually rise to the top like cream in a bottle of milk. I learned better over the next 10 years. The world's a sorry schoolroom sometimes, ain't it?
"Well," Vera said, "we'll give each other a try, Dolores St. George. Although even if you work out, I imagine you'll be pregnant again in a year or so, and that's the last I'll see of you."
The fact was I was 2 months pregnant right then, but wild horses wouldn't have dragged that out of me either. I wanted the $10 a week the job paid, and I got it. And you better believe me when I say I earned every red cent of it. I worked my tail off that summer,
And when Labor Day rolled around, Vera asked me if I wanted to keep on after they went back to Baltimore. Someone has to keep a big place like that up to snuff all the year round, you know. And I said, fine. I kept at it until 6 weeks before Joe Jr. was born. And I was back at it even before he was off the titty. In the summer, I left him with Arlene Cullum. Vera wouldn't have a crying baby in the house, not her. But when she and her husband were gone, I'd bring both him and Selena in with me. Selena could be mostly left alone. Even at 2 going on 3, she could be trusted most of the time. Joe Jr. I carted with me on my daily rounds. He took his first steps in the master bedroom, although you can believe Vera never knew it. She called me a week after I delivered. I almost didn't send her a birth announcement, then decided if she thought I was looking for a fancy present, that was her problem. Congratulated me on giving birth to a son, and then said what I think she really called to say, that she was holding my place for me. I think she intended me to be flattered, and I was. It was about the highest compliment a woman like Vera can pay, and it meant a lot more to me than the $25 bonus check I got in the mail from her in December of that year. She was hard, but she was fair. And around that house of hers, she was always the boss. Her husband wasn't there but 1 day in 10 anyway, even in the summers when they were supposed to be living there full time. But when he was, you still knew who was in charge. Maybe he had 200 or 300 executives who dropped their drawers every time he said ship. But Vera was boss of the shooting match on Little Tall Island. And when she told him to take his shoes off and stop tracking dirt on her nice clean carpet, he minded. And like I say, she had her ways of doing things. Did she ever? I don't know where she got her ideas. Although I have a feeling there was a lassie who scrubbed plenty of floors before she married her a gold mine. But I do know she was a prisoner of them. If things wasn't done a certain way, she'd get a headache or one in her gut. She spent so much of her day checking up on things that I thought plenty of times she would have had more peace of mind if she'd just given over and kept that house herself. All the tubs had to be scrubbed out with spick and span. That was one thing. No less toil, no top job, no Mr. Clean, just spick and span. If she caught you scrubbing one of the tubs with anything else, God help you. When it came to the ironing, you had to use a special spray bottle of starch on the collars of the shirts and blouses. And there was a piece of gauze you were supposed to put over the collar before you sprayed. Friggin' gauze didn't do a goddamn thing, so far as I could ever tell. And I must have ironed at least 10,000 shirts and blouses in that house. But if she came into the laundry room and saw you was doing shirts without that little piece of netting on the collar, or at least hung over the end of the ironing board, God help you. If you didn't remember to turn on the exhaust fan in the kitchen when you were frying something, God help you. The garbage cans in the garage, that was another thing. There were 6 of them. Sonny Quist came once a week to pick up the swill, and either the housekeeper or one of the maids, whoever was most handy, was supposed to bring those cans back into the garage the minute, the very second he was gone. And you couldn't just drag him into the corner and leave him. He had to be lined up 2 and 2 and 2 along the garage's east wall, with their covers turned upside down on top of them. If you forgot to do it just that way, God help you. Then there was the welcome mats. There were 3 of them, one for the front door, one for the patio door, and one for the back door, which had one of those snooty tradesman's entrance signs on it right up until last year, when I got tired of looking at it and took it down. Once a week, I had to take those welcome mats and lay them on a big rock at the end of the backyard. Oh, I'm going to say about 40 yards down from the swimming pool. And beat the dirt out of them with a broom. Really had to make the dust fly. And if you lagged off, she was apt to catch you. She didn't watch every time you beat the welcome mats, but lots of times she would. She'd stand on the patio with a pair of her husband's binoculars. And the thing was, when you brought the mats back to the house, you had to make sure welcome was pointing the right way. The right way was so people walking up to whichever door it was could read it. Put a welcome mat back on the stoop upside down, and God help you. There must have been 4 dozen different things like that. In the old days, back when I started as a day maid, you'd hear a lot of bitching about Vera Donovan down at the general store. The Donovans entertained a lot. All through the 50s, they had a lot of house help. And usually the one bitching loudest was some little girl who'd been hired for part-time and then got fired for forgetting one of the rules 3 times in a row. She'd be telling anyone who wanted to listen that Vera Donovan was a mean, sharp-tongued old bat and crazy as a loon in the bargain. Well, maybe she was crazy and maybe she wasn't, but I can tell you one thing. If you remembered, she didn't give you the heat. And my way of thinking is this. Anyone who can remember who's sleeping with who on all those soap opera stories they show in the afternoon should be able to remember to use spick and span in the tubs and put the welcome mats back down facing the right way. But the sheets now, that was one thing you didn't ever want to get wrong. They had to be hung perfectly even over the lines, so the hems matched, you know. And you had to use 6 clothespins on each one, never 4, always 6. And if you dragged one in the mud, you didn't have to worry about waiting to get something wrong 3 times. The lines have always been out in the side yard, which is right under her bedroom window. She'd go to that window year in and year out and yell at me, 6 pins now, Dolores. You mind me now, 6, not 4. I'm counting, and my eyes are just as good now as they ever were. What, honey? Oh, bosh, Andy, let her alone. That's a fair enough question, and it's one no man would have brains enough to ask. I'll tell you, Nancy Bannister from Kennebunk, Maine, yes, she did have a dryer, a nice big one. But we were forbidden to put the sheets in it unless there was 5 days' rain in the forecast. The only sheet worth having on a decent person's bed is a sheet that's been dried out of doors, Vera would say. Because they smell sweet. They catch a little bit of the wind that flapped them, and they hold it. And that smell sends you off to sweet dreams. She was full of bull about a lot of things, but not about the smell of fresh air in the sheets. About that, I thought she was dead right. Anyone can smell the difference between a sheet that was tumbled in a Maytag and one that was flapped by a good south wind. But there were plenty of winter mornings when it was just 10 degrees and the wind was strong and damp and coming from the east straight in off the Atlantic. On mornings like that, I would have given up that sweet smell without a peep of argument. Hanging sheets in deep cold is a kind of torture. Nobody knows what it's like unless they've done it, and once you've done it, you never, ever forget it. You take the basket out to the lines, and the steam comes rising off the top, and the first sheet is warm. And maybe you think to yourself, if you ain't never done it before, that is, oh, this ain't so bad. But by the time you've got that first one up, and the edge is even, and those 6 pins on, it's stopped steaming. It's still wet, but now it's cold, too. And your fingers are wet, and they're cold. But you go on to the next one, and the next, and your fingers turn red, and they slow up, and your shoulders ache, and your mouth is cramped from holding pins in it, so your hands are free to keep that befrigged sheet nice and even the whole while. But most of the misery is right there in your fingers. If they'd go numb, that'd be one thing. You almost wish they would. But they just get red. And if there are enough sheets to go beyond that to a pale purple color, like the edges of some lilies, by the time you finish, your hands are really just claws. The worst thing, though, is you know what's going to happen when you finally get back inside with that empty laundry basket and the heat hits your hands. They start to tingle, and then they start to throb in the joints. Only it's a feeling so deep, it's really more like crying than throbbing. I wish I could describe it to you so you know, Andy, but I can't. Nancy Bannister there looks like she knows, a little bit anyway. But there is a world of difference between hanging out your wash on the mainland in winter and hanging it out on the island. When your fingers start to warm up again, it feels like there's a hive of bugs in them. So you rub them all over with some kind of hand lotion and wait for the itch to go away. And you know it don't matter how much store lotion or plain old sheep dip you rub into your hands, By the end of February, the skin is still going to be cracked so bad that it'll break open and bleed if you clench a hard fist. And sometimes, even after you've gotten warm again, and maybe even gone to bed, your hands will wake you up in the middle of the night, sobbing with the memory of that pain. You think I'm joking? You can laugh if you want to, but I ain't, not a bit. You can almost hear 'em, like little children who can't find their mamas. It comes from deep inside, and you lie there and listen to it, knowing all the time that you'll be going back outside again just the same. Nothing can stop it, and it's all a part of woman's work no man knows about or wants to know about. And while you were going through that, hands numb, fingers purple, shoulders aching, snot leaking off the end of your nose and freezing tight as a tick to your upper lip, she'd more often than not be standing or sitting there in her bedroom window looking out at you. Her forehead'd be furrowed and her lips drawn down and her hands working on each other. All tensed up she'd be, like it was some kind of complicated hospital operation, instead of just hanging sheets out to dry in the winter wind. You could see her trying to hold herself back, to keep her big trap shut this time. But after a while, she wouldn't be able to no more, and she'd throw up the window and lean out so that cold east wind streamed her hair back, and she'd howl down, 6 pins! Remember to use 6 pins! Don't you let the wind blow my good sheets down to the corner of the yard! Mind me now, you better, because I'm watching and I'm counting! By the time March came, I'd be dreaming of getting the hatchet me and the hunky used to chop up kindling for the kitchen stove. Until he died, that is. After that, I had the job all to myself, lucky me. And hitting that loudmouth bitch a good lick with it right between the eyes. Sometimes I could actually see myself doing it. That's how mad she made me. But I guess I always knew there was a part of her that hated yelling down that way as much as I hated hearing it. That was the first way she had of being a bitch, not being able to help it. It was really worse for her than it was for me, especially after she'd had her bad strokes. There was a lot less washing to hang out by then, but she was just as crazy on the subject as she'd been before most of the rooms in the house were shut off and most of the guest beds stripped and the sheets wrapped in plastic and put away in the linen closet. What made it hard for her was that by 1985 or so, her days of surprising folks was through. She had to depend on me just to get around. If I wasn't there to lift her out of bed and set her in her wheelchair, in bed she stayed. She'd parked up a lot, you see. Went from 130 or so in the early 60s to 190. And most of the gain was that yellowish, blubbery fat you see on some old people. It hung off her arms and legs and butt like bread dough on a stick. Some people get thin as jerky in their sundown years, but not Vera Donovan. Dr. Freneau said it was because her kidneys weren't doing their job. I suppose so, but I had plenty of days when I thought she put on that weight just to spite me. The weight wasn't all, either. She was halfway to being blind as well. The strokes had done that. What eyesight she had left came and went. Some days she could see a little bit out of her left eye and pretty damn good out of the right one. But most times she said it was like looking through a heavy gray curtain. I guess you can understand why it drove her crazy, her that was such a one to always keep her eye on everything. A few times she even cried over it, and you want to believe that it took a lot to make a hard baby like her to cry. And even after the years had beat her to her knees, she was still a hard baby. What, Frank? Senile? I don't know for sure, and that's the truth. I don't think so. And if she was, it sure wasn't in the ordinary way old folks go senile. And I'm not just saying that, because if it turns out she was, the judge in charge of probating her will's apt to use it to blow his nose with. He can wipe his ass with it for all of me. I don't want her money, and I don't want her land, and I don't want her house. Goddamn thing's haunted anyway. All I want's to get out of this friggin' mess she's landed me in. But I still gotta say she probably want completely vacant upstairs, not even at the end. A few rooms to rent, maybe, but not completely vacant. The main reason I say so was she had days when she was almost as sharp as ever. They were usually the same days when she could see a little and help you to sit her up in bed, or maybe even take those 2 steps from the bed to the wheelchair instead of having to be hoisted across like a bag of grain. I put her in the wheelchair so I could change her bed, and she wanted to be in it so she could go over to her window, the one that looked out on the side yard and the harbor view beyond that. She told me once that she'd go out of her mind for good if she had to lay in bed all day and all night with nothing but the ceiling and the walls to look at, and I believed her. She had her confused days, yes, days when she didn't know who I was and hardly even who she was. On those days, she was like a boat that's come loose from its moorings, except the ocean she was adrift on was time. She was apt to think it was 1947 in the morning and 1974 in the afternoon. But she had good days, too. There were less of them as time went on, and she kept having those little strokes, shocks, the old folks call them. But she did have them. Her good days was often my bad ones, though, because she'd get up to all her old bitchery if I let her. She'd get mean. That was the second way she had of being a bitch. That woman could be as mean as cat dirt when she wanted to. Even stuck in a bed most of the time, wearing diapers and rubber pants, she could be a real stinker. The messes she made on cleaning days is as good an example of what I mean as anything. She didn't make them every week, but by God, I'll tell you that she made them on Thursdays too often for it to be just a coincidence. Thursdays was cleaning day at the Donovans. It's a huge house. You don't have any idea until you're actually wandering around inside it, but most of it's closed off. The days when there might be half a dozen girls with their hair done up in kerchiefs, polishing here and washing windows there and dusting cobwebs out of the ceiling corner somewhere else, are 20 years or more in the past. I have walked through those gloomy rooms sometimes, looking at the furniture swaddled up in dust sheets, and thought of how the place used to look back in the '50s, when they had their summer parties. There was always different colored Japanese lanterns on the lawn. How well I remember that. And I get the funniest chill. In the end, the bright colors always go out of life. Have you ever noticed that? In the end, things always look gray, like a dress that's been washed too many times. For the last 4 years, the open part of the house has been the kitchen, the main parlor, the dining room, the sunroom that looks out on the pool and the patio, and 4 bedrooms upstairs, hers, mine, and the 2 guest rooms. The guest rooms weren't heated much in winter time, but they were kept nice in case her children did come to spend some time. Yes, Andy, I do know that. I do. Just let me tell this in my own way, would you? Even in these last few years, I always had 2 girls from town who helped me on cleaning days. There's always been a pretty lively turnover there, but since 1990 or so, it's been Shauna Windham and Frank's sister Susie. I couldn't do it without them, but I still do a lot of it myself. And by the time the girls go home at 4 on Thursday afternoons, I'm about dead on my feet. There's still a lot to do, though. The last of the ironing, Friday's shopping list to write out, and her Nibs' supper to get, of course. No rest for the wicked, as they say. Only before any of those things, like as not, there'd be some of her bitchery to sort out. She was regular about her calls of nature most of the time. I'd slip the bedpan under her every 3 hours, and she'd do a tinkle for me. And on most days there was apt to be a clinker in the pan along with the pee after the noon call. Except on Thursdays, that is. Not every Thursday, but on the Thursdays when she was bright, I could count on trouble more often than not, and on a backache that'd keep me awake until midnight. Even Anison 3 wouldn't take it away from me at the end. I've been healthy as a horse most of my life, and I'm still healthy as a horse, but 65 is 65. You can't shake things off the way you once could. On Thursday, instead of getting half a bedpan filled with pee at 6 in the morning, I'd get just a dribble. The same thing at 9. And at noon, instead of some pee and a clinker, there was apt to be nothing at all. I'd know then I might be in for it. The only times I absolutely knew I was in for it were the times when I hadn't gotten a clinker out of her Wednesday noon, either. I see you trying not to laugh, Andy, but that's all right. You let it out if you have to. Wasn't no laughing matter then, but it's over now, and what you're thinking ain't nothing but the truth. The dirty old bag had her a shit savings account, and it was like some week she banked it in order to collect the interest. Only I was the one who got all the withdrawals. I got 'em whether I wanted 'em or not. I spent most of my Thursday afternoons running upstairs trying to catch her in time, and sometimes I even did. But whatever the state of her eyes might be, there was nothing wrong with her ears. And she knew I never let any of the town girls vacuum the Aubusson rug in the parlor. And when she heard the vacuum cleaner start up in there, she'd crank up her tired old fudge factory, and that shit account of hers would start paying dividends. Then I thought up a way of catching her. I'd yell to one of the girls that I guessed I'd vacuum the parlor next. I'd yell that even if they was both right next door in the dining room. I'd turn on the vacuum all right, but instead of using it, I'd go to the foot of the stairs and stand there with one foot on the bottom step and my hand on the knob of the newel post, like one of those track fellas all hunkered down waiting for the starter to shoot off his gun and let them go.